from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. And on today's Fresh Air, one last look at 1988. Rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the year in rock music and plays some of the best records of the year. And film critic Stephen Schiff dishes up some surprises with his picks for the best and worst movies of the year. Also, poet Mark Halliday joins us to read a poem inspired by the doo-wop group The Capris and by what he calls the moment of pre-adolescence. By the way, that's Dave McKenna at the piano playing Auld Lang Syne as recorded in performance on Fresh Air. We wish you a very happy new year. Before I was old enough to go out on New Year's Eve, the best part of the New Year was listening to my favorite disc jockeys count down the top 100 records of the year. Well, that's not exactly what we're going to do today on Fresh Air, but we are about to hear some of the best records of the year, as chosen by Fresh Air's rock critic Ken Tucker. And he's going to tell us about some of rock's new directions and dead ends in 1988. And yes, he will present his top 10 list and will even give you an address if you'd like to send for copies. Ken writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer. He formerly was the pop music critic for the Inquirer and for the Los Angeles Herald Examiner. Happy New Year, Ken.
Oh, same to you.
Thanks. Is there any performer or trend that you think really defines 1988?
Well, if you believe trade magazines like Billboard, they'll tell you that this is the year of George Michael, which I think if it were really true, I would have to contemplate suicide. It's one of those situations where the man sells 20 million albums, gets number one singles, and I think it's a clear example, one of the purest imaginable, of the way sales figures don't measure cultural impact in pop music anymore. I think that, more broadly speaking, there was no single event or record or star around which 1988 pop kind of organized itself in a way that in previous years when you would have, say, Michael Jackson's Thriller, that was a cultural event, whereas 1988 Michael Jackson releases Bad, and that album is not a cultural event. It's a collection of songs. There was no Live Aid this year as the way there were in years past, a kind of concert that takes over the media attention, even though there was something like the Human Rights Now Amnesty International tour. Whether or not that's just because people got tired of hearing about those big tours or it doesn't capture their imagination or not, I just think that it was a much more scattered and therefore, I think, in a lot of ways, interesting season in popular music.
So should we look at some trends that didn't amount to much?
Sure. I mean, I think that something like the rise of Tracy Chapman was significant in the sense that here was a black woman folk singer getting a number one record, selling, I think, at least 2 million copies, a fairly unprecedented event. And yet at the same time, I found that record to be not quite as revolutionary as it, I think, would like to have presented itself. I think that in a lot of ways that the truly revolutionary record of the year was Public Enemy's It Takes a Nation of Millions to Hold Us Back, which was a rap album. And the reason I bring that up is that I think that when you hear something like Tracy Chapman's song talking about a revolution, I think she never does explain what she means by a revolution, which I think was one way that a large mass audience could buy that album without having it disturb them greatly. And I think that if Tracy Chapman really wanted to say what the terms of revolution were, she would have to use language and ideas that Public Enemy did do in their record.
We'll hear Public Enemy later.
Sure.
But let's hear Tracy Chapman now.
Good.
Don't you know that talking about a revolution sounds like a whisper? Don't you know that talking about a revolution sounds like a whisper? While they're standing in the welfare lines, crying at the doorsteps of those armies of salvation, wasting time in the unemployment lines, sitting around for a promotion. Don't you know, talking about a revolution sounds like a whisper. Who are people gonna rise up and get their share? Who are people we're gonna rise up and take what's theirs.
That's Tracy Chapman. Ken, I was really surprised at how much airplay this got, at how well the record sold. I thought it was going to be on college stations, and I'm not sure what explains the sudden commercial success of the type of record that was usually confined to alternative stations.
Yeah, I don't know precisely what either, but I certainly think that her image really captured people, that in a certain way you were buying an image as much as you were buying a record. I mean, I certainly don't deny her talent. I think she does have strengths as both a songwriter and as a singer. Yet at the same time, I think that there's something limiting about that. I was reading an essay by that great rock critic Walter Benjamin, written in 1934. He was talking about literature, but I think that there's a phrase that he used that was exactly appropriate to Tracy Chapman's record, which is that he says that the struggle against misery is turned into an object of consumption. And I think that that's exactly what happens. These kinds of protest songs are so smoothly developed that that it just becomes another record, another pop record to enjoy as a hit.
Rock critic Ken Tucker is with us, and we're looking at the year of 1988 in rock music. Let's move on to hard rock.
Yeah, this was a very big year for hard rock commercially. You had the presence of bands like Guns N' Roses and Def Leppard kind of constantly throughout the year in the top 10, which was significant in the sense that they're both fairly young acts, especially Guns N' Roses, an L.A. hard rock band. And they shared time on the charts with music that was completely the opposite, the Tracy Chapman record, a lot of movie soundtracks like The Dirty Dancing, lots of oldies. And so this was kind of a resurgence of that kind of youthful music. And I think that the Guns N' Roses album, in fact, was probably indeed the best commercial mainstream pop hard rock album released this year. I think it kind of deserved its popularity in that sense. I think as has come out in kind of interviews and their public presentation, they themselves are sort of jerks, but they're very talented jerks. But I also think that you have also the rise of a band like Metallica, which also has an album in the top 10. A year ago, Metallica was considered a speed metal band, an offshoot of punk rock, a very obscure band, and suddenly finds itself very much a mainstream taste. And I think in that sense, what I found to be the most exciting, loud, abrasive music was by a New York band called Sonic Youth. And they put an album out called Daydream Nation, a double record set. That's by far their most accessible record, and I think in many ways their best record. And I think that if in this year Metallica and Guns N' Roses could crack the top 10, it would seem to me that Sonic Youth's record, which was just fairly recently released, and going into 1989 could easily become just as accessible.
Let's play something by Sonic Youth.
Good. This is a song called Total Trash.
It started the top. Now it's spiraling down. What's best when it's lost? Digging under the ground. Never mind it now. We can bring it back. It's total trash. And it's a natural fact that I'm not no cow.
You know what I find interesting about this? This is actually the first time I'm hearing Sonic Youth after reading about them for a while. But their voices are really very controlled.
Yeah, well, I think in that record in particular, this new one, they've brought the voices forward more, and you can hear them more, and they're interesting voices. I mean, I think you can pick up influences. You can hear that sort of Lou Reed, Velvet Underground sort of influence. But at the same time, it's very original, I think, the way they're combining that real raw, feedbacky guitar with those kinds of vocals.
This was a year where there were several interesting comebacks.
There were many, many comebacks, many attempted comebacks, many failed comebacks. People like Patti Smith and Boz Scaggs and Hall & Oates, Jimmy Page of Led Zeppelin, all making these records that just failed dismally in the marketplace. I think that Pat Benatar made a sort of comeback after a couple of years that was should have been recognized as a hit. Same with Joni Mitchell. These things didn't do too well. I think the music industry is beginning to realize that if you take that long an absence from the scene, there is indeed a good chance you'll be forgotten. But I thought one of the most interesting comebacks and commercial failures was by Brian Wilson, who put out his first solo album, apart from the Beach Boys work that he's done. And I thought it was a wonderful record. It didn't do very well at all. And the irony I thought there was that the Beach Boys, without Brian Wilson, scored their first number one single in more than a decade with a song called Kokomo from the movie Cocktail. A lot of people are kind of using this as a kind of yin and yang. It's like, oh, those awful, hideous Beach Boys. I actually thought Kokomo was pretty good. I think you have to be able to listen to it and get past the fact that arch conservative jerk Mike Love is singing the lead, but I think it's a thoroughly respectable Beach Boys song. But I do think that the Brian Wilson record is much more interesting and inventive and witty.
And for people who don't know them, we should mention that Brian Wilson used to be the main songwriter and lead singer
producer
of
yes.
the Beach Boys.
Yeah, I mean, he's really responsible for the Beach Boys sound.
Should we play something from his comeback record?
Yeah, it was a really terrific song that was released as a single and flopped called Walkin' the Line.
That's Brian Wilson, and all the voices on there.
That's
Brian
right.
Wilson.
Yeah, it's all Brian Wilson overdubbed. I mean, I think it's a great story about him. I mean, in a sense, I think it suffered from the publicity campaign around that record, which was primarily directed toward Brian Wilson's physical and psychic rehabilitation after a breakdown he had had in his work with Dr. Eugene Landy, the therapist that he worked with, and Landy gets credit on the lyrics and things like that. And there was a lot of controversy about that, and I think it obscured what was a really nice, bright pop record.
Any other comebacks you want to note?
Yeah, I think that Randy Newman had not made an album in 5 years. 5 years is pretty much of a generation in pop terms, and I think that his album, Land of Dreams, initially I reviewed it for Fresh Air and had lots of reservations about it. I felt that it was kind of too much of a throwback to his earlier work in the way the same themes seemed to be explored. But the more I listen to it, I must say, it's really one of those things where a second, third, fifth, tenth, 20th listen has yielded a lot more on it. And I really like the record a lot. I like the way the music is arranged. I think there's really some beautiful melodies on it, quite aside from whatever you may think of whether or not the jokes in it are cheap or not. And I really like, in particular, one of the toughest songs on it, one called Roll with the Punches.
Why don't we give it a listen?
They say that people living in the street, no food in the belly, no shoes on the feet, six black children living in a burned up room, one bare light bulb swinging. Little black kid come home from school, put his key in the door, Mr. Rats on the stairway, Mr. Junk is lying his own vomit on the floor. You got to roll with the punches, little black boy. That's what you got to do. You got to roll with the punches. Tap it, baby. It's all these boring people. See them on TV. Making up all these boring stories about how bad.
I love the kind of vaudevillian piano that he's playing.
Yeah, combined with that faintly ominous vocal. I think it's really neat.
That's Randy Newman's latest album. And why don't we take a look at what's happening in black pop in the year of 1988?
Yeah, I thought there were a lot of really strong black pop singles. I think there are a lot of black acts, in a way that had been denied to them in the past few years, had much more access to radio stations, and really there were a lot more crossover singles. I thought the biggest success story in that area was DJ Jazzy Jeff and the Fresh Prince, which had a huge hit with Parents Just Don't Understand. I think that there were new acts like Bobby Brown, who had a terrific song called My Prerogative. Bobby Brown used to be in First Edition. There's a new group called The Boys that Motown Records has, that's really the first kid act since the Jackson 5 that has really come up with something very strong. I think this song, Dial My Heart, which is a big hit single right now, even as we speak, is it's like a real raw early Jackson 5 kind of song.
Let's hear it. A group called The Boys.
That's right. I should have said that when I was talking about Bobby Brown, I meant New Edition, not First Edition. That's newspaper kind of talk, I guess.
And my guest is Ken Tucker, who writes for a newspaper, the Philadelphia Inquirer, where he, as the television critic, writes about popular culture. He was formerly the rock music critic there, also former rock music critic at the Los Angeles Herald Examiner, and of course, rock critic for Fresh Air. And what we're doing is reviewing the year of 1988 in rock music, and we'll have more of some of the best records of 1988 after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Rock critic Ken Tucker is my guest, and we're reviewing some of the best records of 1988. Ken, most of the records you've played, you've played because they indicated certain new directions, or that they were especially good in their genre of rock.
Right.
But the next records we're going to hear are actually on your 10 best list. You thought these were some of the best of 1988.
Yeah, as far as my own favorites, records like Womack and Womack's Conscious, I thought was a wonderful record. And I thought Public Enemy had made by far the strongest rap record, and in many ways the strongest pop album of the year. It's an album called It Takes a Nation of Millions to Hold Us Back. It was put out by Def Jam Records, a rap label, but I think that one of the reasons I love it and I'm fascinated by it and play it over and over again is the way it combines so many different kinds of music. I mean, I hear kind of harmelodic Ornette Coleman jazz in it. I hear rap music. I hear Sly Stone, James Brown. There's all sorts of influences working there. A lot of people are kind of leery. I notice a lot of people talk to me about this record and say, yeah, I like the sound of it, but what they're saying is, you know, it's all this kind of militant Louis Farrakhan kind of stuff. And I think that given the context in which this record exists, that it's a real interesting statement. I don't find it offensive, racist at all. I find that in the context in which it exists in an essentially racist music industry, it's a very, very strong statement.
What would you like to play from it?
I'd like to play a song called Don't Believe the Hype.
Well, here's what I want you all to do for me.
And all those things you know.
Yeah, boy, part two.
bum rush the show. Yo, Grip!
Get the green, black, and red in. Gold down, countdown, and Armageddon. 8828, the S1s will put the left in effect, and I still will rock the hard jams, treat it like a seminar. Reach the bourgeois and rock the boulevard. Some say I'm negative, but then I'm positive. What I got to give?
The media says this.
Red,
yo,
black,
don't
and green.
That height. They got to be
you know what
that
I
tight.
Mean?
You know what I'm saying? Yo, the megas got them going up to see Captain Kirk like the jerk, and they out of work. Let me tell y'all a little something, man. A lot of people on daytime radio scared of us because they too ignorant to understand the lyrics of the truth that we pumping into them clouds, that brain cells, that they're spotting under them wooden skulls they call caps, you know what I'm saying? But the S1s are straightening it out quick, fast, in a hurry. Don't worry, flavor vision ain't blurry, you know what I'm saying? Yo, Terminator X!
Can't you think that this record is evidence that rap hasn't dead-ended?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, I think this is one of those records that either gives you a headache or you lock into so completely that you're totally in on its wavelength. And I think that's, to a certain extent, it's not a huge hit. I mean, relatively speaking, it's gone gold, which means it's sold over 500,000 copies. But I think that it's one of those records that much more than, say, what George Michael has done actually has an effect. I mean, people now have to, in rap, in other forms of music, confront what Public Enemy have done and go on from there because they've, I think, kind of set a new standard for what that music is.
You surprised at how well rap has endured? I mean, did you expect it to be a novelty that would be gone the year after it started?
I did, sort of. But at the same time, it was always clear to me that rap was such a logical extension from what had been happening with James Brown, Sly Stone. I very much saw it as George Clinton's funk music in the 70s. I really saw a certain line of influence there that if it could have been sustained, and I think it has now for 10 full years, and they still don't play it on MTV regularly, that it could last forever.
Let's get to one other record from your top 10 list.
Yeah, the other record that I really like a great deal is Womack and Womack's Conscience. This was their third album. Womack and Womack are Linda and Cecil Womack, a husband and wife team. Linda is Sam Cooke's daughter. Cecil is the brother of Bobby Womack, who had a lot of hits, songwriting hits, about 10 years ago. And I just think it's a wonderful record of a completely different nature about marriage and commitment and family life and the importance of all those things, things that lots of people think aren't in rock and roll and certainly are evident here.
Let's hear it. That's Womack and Womack. The song is Conscious of My Conscience. One of the things I really enjoy about their records is that, well, they're both great singers, and you can really hear them singing. I think one of the things that's happened to a lot of black pop music is something that happened even long before in a lot of white pop music, and that is it really kind of became a producer's art in a way, and that the voices were almost so processed that a lot of the voices have become anonymous. It's sometimes hard to tell one from another because they're so processed and so in the background in the mix.
Yeah, I think that Womack and Womack are so confident in their abilities as singers that they're not afraid to let that kind of raw edge to their voices show, and in fact they strive for that because I think that obviously I think it conveys a lot more emotion and they can get a lot more emotional range by singing the way they do. There's a lot more, what I really like about it is the way the whole album is this conversation between the two of them. They alternate songs talking to each other. One song that she's written addresses a song that he's written and answers it. It's real interesting that way.
Well, I have a fabulous offer to announce, and that is Ken Tucker's top 10 list is being made available. If you would like a copy of his top 10 list, which he's about to read, you can just send us a self-addressed stamped envelope to Fresh Air, WHYY, Independence Mall West, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 19106. I'll give that address again after we hear the top 10. And just to explain, a lot of the records that we've heard today aren't necessarily on the top 10 list. Some of them were just indicative of interesting new trends in 1988 or just very good records. But Ken, why don't you read your actual top 11 or...
top 11, top 10.
Yeah.
Yeah, these are in no particular order, I think, once we get past the first couple, but they're all, I think, really strong records. The Public Enemy record, It Takes a Nation of Millions to Hold Us Back. The Womack and Womack record, Conscience. And then Prince, Love Sexy. The Was Not Was record, What Up Dog is the name of it. Brian Wilson's album, which is just called Brian Wilson. Randy Newman's record, Land of Dreams. Rodney Crowell, I thought, made the strongest country album of the year called Diamonds and Dust. Till Tuesday's album, Everything's Different Now. Grievously overlooked album, Nick Lowe's Pinker and Prouder Than Previous, which I just like to say the title anyway. And what else? Joni Mitchell, Chalk Mark and a Rainstorm, another comeback that failed that was a great record. And I really liked The Traveling Wilburys, Volume 1.
So that's Ken Tucker's top, I think it's 11,
yeah,
of 1988.
Yes, I think so.
And if you'd like a copy, you can write to us. Just send us a self-addressed stamped envelope, and we'll send you a copy, and at no extra charge, we'll give you his top singles of the year as well. So the address is Fresh Air, WHYY, Independence Mall West, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 19106. Well, Ken, I want to wish you a very happy new year.
Well, same to you.
And I thank you very much for sharing some of the best records of the year with us.
Thanks, well, thanks.
For being
it was
here.
Fun.
My guest has been Fresh Air's rock critic, Ken Tucker, who writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, my guest will be film director George Romero. His debut film, Night of the Living Dead, is a horror classic. It's in the archives of the Museum of Modern Art, and his latest film, Monkey Shines, has just come out on video. Well, Ken, let me ask you now to introduce the best novelty record of 1988.
I think the best novelty record has to be what Tom Jones has done to the Prince song, Kiss.
You don't have to be beautiful to turn me on. I just need your body, baby, from dusk till dawn. You don't need experience to turn me out. You just leave it all up to me. I'll show you what it's all about. You don't have to be rich to be my girl. You don't have to be cool to rule my world. Ain't no particular sign I'm more compatible with. I just
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. And coming up, we look back at the movies of 1988. Fresh Air film critic Stephen Schiff joins us with his take on the 10 best and 10 worst films of the year. Also, pianist and singer Dr. John performs a few songs. And poet Mark Halliday reads for us. He has a stubborn habit of writing poetry inspired by rock songs. We'll hear an ode to the doo-wop group, The Capris. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Brian Naylor. President Reagan and President-elect Bush were subpoenaed today as defense witnesses in the upcoming criminal trial of Oliver North. The former National Security Council aide is charged with illegally diverting profits from Iranian arms sales to the Contras in Nicaragua. A White House statement said the subpoena of President Reagan was, quote, not an unanticipated development, and that it raises significant legal and constitutional questions which are currently being reviewed by the Department of Justice. The statement said it would be unprecedented for a president to appear as a witness at a criminal trial. Saturday's editions of the Times of London say the bomb that destroyed Pan Am Flight 103 over Scotland last week was put aboard the plane in Frankfurt. The newspaper said the team investigating the crash told Scottish police that a Palestinian terrorist cell had been operating in Frankfurt for the past 18 months. British investigators believe a sophisticated device with two triggering mechanisms set off the bomb that led to the crash that killed some 270 people. The son-in-law of former Soviet leader Leonid Brezhnev was sentenced today to 12 years in a maximum security labor camp. The Soviet Supreme Court found him guilty of taking bribes worth $150,000, NPR's Ann Cooper reports.
The court sentenced Yuri Cherbanov and six officials from the Republic of Uzbekistan for their roles in a complex corruption scandal that began during Brezhnev's 18-year rule. The 52-year-old Cherbanov is married to Brezhnev's daughter Galina. Before their wedding in 1971, Cherbanov was a junior-level police official, but his career took off after the marriage, and by 1980, he was the Soviet Union's second-ranking police official. The Supreme Court ruled that Cherbanov used his position to protect Uzbek officials who were defrauding the government by filing false reports about cotton production in Uzbekistan. Cherbanov conceded that he got money from the Uzbeks, but he insisted he did nothing in exchange for it. The trial was widely regarded here as a judgment on the Brezhnev era, which is routinely condemned in the Soviet press as a time of rampant corruption and cronyism. I'm Ann Cooper in Moscow.
Afghan President Najibullah said today he will observe a ceasefire proposed by Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev. But rebel leaders have already rejected the January 1st truce. Lise Doucette reports from Kabul.
With less than 2 months left before Soviet troops are expected to withdraw from Afghanistan, President Najibullah's announcement reflects this government's concern that time is running out, that a political solution must be found if even more bloodshed is to be avoided. The president told the Afghan army to stay at their posts and not to fire unless attacked. He appealed to the Mujahideen to do likewise, adding that his forces would observe a truce until January 4th, his deadline for the guerrillas' response. The Mujahideen say they agree that a political solution must be found. The seven parties based in Pakistan recently held talks with Moscow's ambassador to Kabul, Yuli Voronsov, as part of efforts to form a new broad-based government. But Kabul is still out in the cold. The Mujahideen have not budged on their refusal to share power with the regime they denounce as a Soviet puppet.
Lise Doucette reporting for the BBC. The Free Trade Agreement is now law in Canada. The Canadian Senate approved the agreement today, which eliminates practically all trade barriers between the U.S. and Canada. Debate over the pact forced Prime Minister Brian Mulroney to call new elections last month. Opponents argued the trade pact would result in a total loss of Canada's identity to its southern neighbor. But supporters, especially big business, welcomed the agreement as a potential economic boon. Stock prices were lower today in mixed trading on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell more than 14 points, closing the year at 2168.57, but advances led decline 7-5. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. For the past few weeks, we've been hearing from our performer-in-residence, Mac Rebenek. Mostly, he's been sharing the music he grew up hearing and playing in his native New Orleans. Here's some of Mac Rebenek's own music from the 1960s. That's when he combined elements of voodoo, psychedelia, and medicine shows in his persona of Dr. John the Night Tripper.
Yeah, down in South Louisiana, we got a thing they call in Haiti, they call it hoodoo, and other areas they call Sanery and other names, but in Louisiana, we call it Gri-Gri, and it's a little homegrown form of herbal remedies and homeopathic medicine or whatever you like to call it, but did an album in tribute to this called Gri-Gri under the name of Dr. John the Night Tripper, and here's a little bit of that music called I Walk on Gilded Splinters. You know, some people think I'm jiving. I know they must be crazy. Don't see their misfortune, else they just lazy. Just be the Grand Zumbi. My yellow belt is shawls on. Ain't afraid of no tomcats, and I fill my brain with poison. Walk through the fire, fly through the smoke. See my enemy on the end of their road. Walk on pins and needles, see what they can do. Walk on gilded splinters with the king of the Zulu. Had a thing about your con, boone kill the con con. Walk on gilded splinters, con, boone kill the con con. Walk on gilded splinters. Roll out my coffin, I drink poison in my chalice. Your pride begin to fade, you're all gonna feel my malice. Some Gri-Gri on your doorstep, soon you'll be in the gutter. Melt your heart like butter, I can make you stutter with your con. Boone kill the con con. Walk on gilded splendors, con. Boone kill the con con. Walk on gilded splendors. Up note, here's a little tune I like to do called Such a Night. I had the pleasure of doing it in the last waltz with the band. Such a night. Such a night. Sweet confusion. Such a night, such a night. Got to steal away. Time seemed right. Baby, your eyes met mine, and at a glance, you let me know this was my chance. You came in with my best friend Jim. Here I am and I'm trying to steal you away from him. If I don't do it, somebody else will. If I don't do it, somebody else will. If I don't do it, somebody else will. If I don't do it, child, somebody else will. And it's such a night.
such a night. Sweet confusion, time seemed bright. Such a night, such a night. Got to steal away under the moonlight. Baby, I couldn't believe my ears. My heart just skipped a beat. Told me we could slip away, yeah. Down a dark end of the street, came in with my best friend Jim. Here I am, I'm trying to steal you away from him. I don't do it, somebody else will. If I don't do it, somebody else will. If I don't do it, somebody else will. If I don't do it, somebody else will. And a long head grooves that I always love to play. I think something like this.
Dr. John's classic recording of Night Tripper music, Gree Gree, has been reissued by Alligator Records. This is Fresh Air. It's that time of year when critics are busy making lists. Our film critic Stephen Schiff is joining us with his lists of the 10 best and 10 worst films of 1988. We're going to talk about some of those films, but first we'll let Stephen count down his picks for the 10 best films of the year.
Starting with number 10, Hairspray. Number 9, Bird. 8, Beetlejuice. 7, Tequila Sunrise. 6, Wings of Desire, but I only admit the first half. 5, Hotel Terminus, The Life and Times of Klaus Barbie. 4, Dead Ringers. 3, Bull Durham. 2, A Cry in the Dark. And number 1, Women on the Verge of a Nervous Breakdown.
What was so good about Women on the Verge that made it all the way to the top of the list?
Well, for me, it was, for one thing, an almost perfect movie. Just delightful from the moment it opened to the moment it ended. And funny and original and beautiful to look at. Strange, funny to look at. A movie like nothing you've ever seen, and yet with hints of sort of decades of pop culture sort of seeping into it. It's about women and loss, but it's done with so much love for women by Almodovar, the director Pedro Almodovar, that its sentiment sort of becomes hip, and that's something that's very new in movies and something that we've lost. I mean, we need a little bit of sentiment in movies. We need a little bit of feeling, and to make it seem hip again, to feel that kind of stormy, Sturm und Drang kind of emotion is quite an achievement.
Now, Almodovar is a Spanish film director. Two of the other directors on your list are also foreign. Hotel Terminus by a French director,
Marcel
Ophuls.
Right.
And, Wings of Desire by the German director Wim Wenders.
That's right.
Is three a typical number for you of foreign directors that make it to the top 10 list?
Well, I think it varies a lot. There happen to be a lot of good American films this year, an unusual number of good American films. And I think that something is happening in Hollywood at the moment. I think that there's a kind of propensity by the studios, of all people, to look at an adult audience, to look at what might once have been an art film audience, and to welcome them back into the fold. And I feel that the sort of tendency for repetition and redundancy among the teenage films of the last 10 years is sort of being swept aside. There have been hints over the last few years that movies that, a more adult audience could appreciate. Some of them fairly lousy. I thought Fatal Attraction was fairly lousy, and Jagged Edge could be hits. And when you get a ball like that rolling, it's liable to produce much better movies.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's time for your 10 worst list. Before you read the list to us, how does a film qualify for one of your 10 worst?
Well, you know, I mean, there are a lot of really bad movies every year. I mean, it's no good sort of knocking again a film like Cocktail or a film like Vibes or a film like Halloween Part, whatever it was this year. I mean, it's just too easy. To make my 10 worst list, a film has to really have made a nuisance of itself. It has to have been acclaimed.
It has to have ambitions.
It has to have ambitions. It has to have been acclaimed by a lot of people. It has to have taken a lot of people for a ride. It has to have met with some success. People have to have taken it seriously. I wish to disabuse them of that notion.
Let me point out, some of our listeners will think this is a rather perverse way of doing a 10 worst list. Last year, your number one worst film of the year was Fatal Attraction, which made it to number one probably on a lot of 10 best lists.
Well, that's true. That's absolutely true.
Okay, here we go with the 10 worst.
All right. Number 10, Gorillas in the Mist. Number 9, Midnight Run. Number 8, Mystic Pizza. Number 7, Punchline. Number 6, U2, Rattle and Hum. Number 5, School Days. Number 4, Crossing Delancey. Number 3, Coming to America. Number 2, Mississippi Burning. And number 1, the worst film of 1988, Willow.
You know, I never even got around to seeing Willow, and for the life of me, I can't even remember what it was.
Well, Willow was that George Lucas fantasy that had little trolls and little strange creatures running around, and oh my, it was a real botch.
Mississippi Burning is an example of a film I've already seen on several 10 best lists.
Oh, Mississippi Burning will, I hereby predict, win the Best Picture Oscar.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was just a ghastly film. I think I don't think we really need yet another film that reduces the civil rights struggle, which is maybe the bravest social movement of the last three decades, to a war between the nice white people and the mean white people, and with the blacks in the background sort of as victims and little scared people running away. I mean, that is really not what it was about, and it's a terrible betrayal.
Would you run down for us your choices for 5 best actors and actresses of the year?
Yep. The best actor... awards in
the envelope, please.
Yeah, exactly. In 5th place, Bill Murray for Scrooged. In 4th place, Tom Hanks for Punchline and Big. In 3rd, Michael Keaton for Beetlejuice and Clean and Sober. 2nd, Jeremy Irons in Dead Ringers. And 1st, Dennis Quaid in a terrible movie, Everybody's All American.
Let me just ask you about Dennis Quaid. You know, it's the kind of performance that you think, in a way, is gunning for an Academy Award because it spans decades and he has certain prosthetic devices to show himself aging. Do you think the performance transcended all of that?
Yeah, I do, because I thought, with all that going on, it was nevertheless extremely deeply felt, mm-hmm. beautifully observed. You know, there are a lot of sort of showboaty performances out there. Dustin Hoffman comes to mind in Rain Man, where a good deal of what's going on is a kind of actor's stunt. Even Jeremy Irons playing two people in Dead Ringers. But I think it's just as mistaken to dismiss it as a stunt when there's a lot more going on mm-hmm. as it is to sort of worship a stunt in which nothing is going on besides the stunt. And I think Dennis Quaid's performance was really admirable.
And the 5 best actresses?
Number 5, Carmen Mora in Women on the Verge of a Nervous Breakdown. Number 4, Meryl Streep in A Cry in the Dark. 3, Diane Keaton in The Good Mother. Number 2, Judy Davis in High Tide. And number 1, Bette Midler in Big Business and Beaches.
Both of which you didn't like very much, right?
Yeah, I dislike both of those movies intensely. But I thought, you know, the sort of the bounty that is Bette Midler on the screen was overwhelming and great fun. And I mean, Beaches was just a disastrously terrible movie, but her presence in it somehow made it watchable, much as Dennis Quaid's in Everybody's All-American, another quite terrible movie.
You know, some of Meryl Streep's fans seem to be turning on her now. She's now being considered by people who once liked her a lot as relying too much on accents and exterior in her performances.
Well, this addresses something we were talking about before, where the stunt, that goes into a performance like that becomes the only thing in people's mind when actually there's a great deal else going on and the stunt is the vehicle. You know, I mean, when this kind of thing was being pioneered in the early 70s with, and in the late 70s, it really peaked with Robert De Niro's performance in Raging Bull. But before that, with Marlon Brando in The Godfather, this sort of absolutely meticulous, detailed impersonation where you change your body and you change your voice and you change your weight. And I think people do get kind of impatient with it. At the same time, Meryl Streep's performance in A Cry in the Dark is much more than her mastery of the Aussie accent. It is, I think, her best performance to date. It is completely uncompromising. It is absolutely chilling in its willingness to be unsympathetic, to be as cold and strange as the woman she portrays actually was, and to earn the tears that movie, I think, does earn the hard way by actually making you sympathize for an entire human condition instead of for someone who's cute or nice or likable or fetching in some way.
One more quick question, and then we'll have to wrap up. You've just presented several of your lists wrapping up the year. Do you like this time of year when you have to sit down and make 10 best and 10 worst lists?
Well, you know, this almost becomes an art form of a very, very, very minor sort. What would it be like? a seashell sculpture or, some kind of really, lower form of macrame. But when you're forming these lists, you do kind of create an aesthetic effect, at least, I feel that you do, almost the way a trailer does in a movie. It has a kind of concentration of all your experiences at the movies. It gives off this kind of rapid-fire blur, this kind of spray of feeling and memory that makes it more fun than it ought to be. I mean, doing that list is really beneath us all and is nevertheless a guilty pleasure that I take.
Well, Stephen, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you.
Thanks for being with us.
Bye.
Fresh Air film critic Stephen Schiff. Here's music composed by Danny Elfman for the film Beetlejuice. This is Fresh Air. Alex Chadwick is joining us from Washington, D.C. with a preview of what's coming up on All Things Considered. Alex, what are you doing today?
Terry, there is news of a sorting out of corruption charges in the Soviet Union. The son-in-law of Mr. Brezhnev, the former Secretary General of the Communist Party, the leader of that country until several years ago when he died, his son-in-law has been sentenced to 12 years in jail for corruption. And a trial that concluded and sentencing that concluded today in Moscow. We'll have a report. Also, the entire government of Yugoslavia, the leaders of the government, the prime minister and his entire cabinet, have resigned. Also, we're going back to look at some of the stories of 1988 and supply footnotes and updates and bring you what's happened since.
Thanks, Alex. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Poet Mark Halliday says he's got a stubborn habit of writing poems about early rock and roll songs that are still stuck in his memory. His collection of poems, published in the 1987 National Poetry Series, was named after Little Star, a 1958 hit by the Elegants. And today he's going to read a poem about the moment of pre-adolescence, inspired by a record by the Capris, There's a Moon Out Tonight.
There's a
The Capris. How do I feel about There's a Moon Out Tonight by the Capris? I thought you'd never ask. Marcia Kuman lived across Cherry Lane, getting tall, taller than me in fifth grade, and smiling behind her glasses. She knew something. The summer nights in Raleigh were thick with something bright in the dark. You could ride bikes under the moon and in and out of lampshine at the corner of Wade and Dogwood, not caring about touching a girl, or later, not caring much still, but happy to be a boy who could someday have a girl, and conscious of a shivering beauty caught in the word, girl. There's a girl at my side that I adore. The Caprice knew something altogether, and it called for this new verb, to adore. Something out there ahead of my bicycle in the dark. I cared a lot about Paladin on Have Gun Will Travel, but did I adore him? Scotty Kooman, years older, got sort of pale and brittle when he went to visit a certain girl in his class. He seemed to have trouble breathing. There's a glow in my heart I never felt before. Not exactly in my heart yet, but it was what would be there if I rode just maybe deeper down Dogwood Lane in the busy dark. Across Dogwood lived Ann Daly, who had freckles and an awesome kind of largeness, not fat but big, and this made my eyes feel hot and burny. She moved slowly, doing chores in her yard. Her long, tanning thighs seemed sarcastic, as if she knew soon her freckled beauty must positively carry her somehow out, out and away. And Shelby Wilson one night kissed her on the lips. I saw it happen, on the sofa, in the basement. Her folks weren't home. Right on the lips. Amazing lips are in your future, boy. That's what the Caprice were telling me. The North Carolina moon is natural, and it can find you anywhere. You have to let the moon paint you and your bike and the picture of Elvis in your pocket, and it shines down on Marcia's hair and on the thought of the green eyes of Ann Daly. Ride and wait, wait and watch. You laugh, you shiver in the summer cool dark. You speak of the Yankees and the Pirates, but cut a side glance at Marcia's tall shape. But when she says anything serious, exasperate her, yelling Little Richard's wop-bop-a-loop-bop. But this dodging, dodging, will end, somewhere, the Caprice being on Marcia's side. Baby, I never felt this way before. I guess it's because there's a moon out tonight. And once that shining starts, no amount of irony will ever quite ride the Caprice out of town. I picture a deep pool with yellow flowers drifting on the surface. The song pours up out of that pool.
I guess it's because there's a
moon out tonight.
Moon out tonight.
Moon out tonight.
There's a moon out tonight.
Mark Halliday's collection of poems, Little Star, is published by William Morrow. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time, the serious business of comedy with comedian Carol Leifer. Though she's a frequent guest on Late Night with David Letterman, she says she still gets her share of audiences who dare her to make them laugh. Rock historian Ed Ward profiles two Mexican-American groups, Sam the Sham and the Pharaohs, and Question Mark and the Mysterians. Ed says that in their own weird way, they made their mark. And television critic David Bianculli takes a look at what the first few months of the new year will bring us in the way of television. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, and Naomi Person. Production assistants from Ed Doherty, Lisa Bruton, and Becky Thorne. And we'd like to thank those dedicated souls who have helped us throughout the year with research assistance. Thanks to Joan MacArthur, Kathy Franke, Briar Foray, John Miller, Martin Foys, Doug Loynes, Dan Cornwell, Georgina Sanger, and Joanna Simon. Our engineer is Richard Parker. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross, and all of us at Fresh Air wish you a very happy and healthy new year. This is NPR, National Public Radio.